Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at what the surprise and imminent abdication of Denmark's Queen Margrethe and the country's new king mean for all of Europe's royal families. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for The Documentary, Lives Less Ordinary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 12th of January. The US and Britain carry out strikes on the Houthis in Yemen in response to their attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. We look at what it all means. Israel makes its case at the International Court of Justice, rejecting the accusation that it's committing genocide in Gaza. And China steps in to broker a deal between Myanmar's ruling military and armed rebel groups who've been taking territory in the north. Also in the podcast, the vast structure in space challenging our understanding of the universe.
This big ring is 1.3 billion light years across. So this is almost the equivalent of looking at 15 full moons lined up.
And
at the moment, I think I've got it on my face. So if you just pop into the camera, you'll see that you actually...
So I could be you a second.
Right now, yeah.
How deep fakes could threaten our security. Since November, the Houthis in Yemen have attacked at least 27 ships in the Red Sea, an average of one every 2 days. They say they're acting in response to Israeli military action in Gaza. But the Houthi threat has disrupted the key trade route via the Suez Canal. An international coalition led by the US had tried to protect shipping in the area, but to no avail. Thursday saw the worst attack yet. And so American and British forces have now carried out strikes on Houthi targets in Yemen. British military footage showed jets and a tanker aircraft taking off from an airbase in Cyprus. A Houthi official said 5 people had been killed in Yemen. But the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, said he had no choice but to join the US in striking Houthi targets in Yemen.
Our aim is very clear. It's to de-escalate tensions and to restore stability to the region. That's why allies over the past few weeks have issued several statements of condemnation of what's happening, calling on the Houthis to desist. Indeed, just this week we've seen a UN Security Council resolution condemning what's happening and saying that states have a right to self-defence. We have acted in self-defence. It's incumbent now on the Houthis to stop carrying out these attacks, putting people's lives at risk and disrupting the global economy, which will also have a damaging impact on people's day-to-day lives. That's not right. We've seen the disruption that that's brought over the past year or two with the situation in Russia and Ukraine. We don't want to see that happen again, and that's why it's right that we've taken action.
Rishi Sunak speaking on a visit to Ukraine. For his part, US President Joe Biden said the airstrikes were supported by Australia, Bahrain, Canada and the Netherlands. But they've been criticised by Russia, China and Iran. Even Saudi Arabia, which has been fighting the Houthis for years, said it was concerned about the possibility of an escalation. The Houthi military spokesman, Yahya Saria, warned the US and Britain would face retaliation.
The American and British enemies bear full responsibility for their criminal aggression against our Yemeni people. It will not go unpunished or unanswered. The Yemeni armed forces will not hesitate to target all threats and all hostile targets on land and sea in order to defend Yemen, its sovereignty and its independence.
For more details on what was attacked in Yemen, I spoke to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
There have been a total of 60 targets in 16 sites,
in the main cities of Sana'a, the capital, Hodeidah, with the main port on the Red Sea, Dhamar, and a number of other places. So far more extensive, I have to say, than what most people had predicted. It was thought that if and when these airstrikes went in, that they would probably try and hit simply coastal defences, possibly going for some radar sites. But they seem to have been pretty extensive. I mean, there's no question that the US-led coalition has obviously got pretty good intelligence on the nature of the Houthi sites. They've hit missile storage sites, airfields, radar bases, even some command and control centres. The casualty seems to have been very light, which I'm sure is deliberate, because what the US-led coalition is looking to do is essentially to deter the Houthis from any further attacks on shipping, rather than inflicting massive damage on them or on Yemen. I mean, don't forget, this is a country that is already emerging from 8 years of civil war, with over 150,000 people killed. So the last thing it needs is another conflict. But the Houthis have brought this on themselves by attacking shipping, and they don't really seem to be showing any signs of letting up.
Will these series of airstrikes help protect shipping going forward?
It doesn't look like it. They have vowed to continue their attacks. The way the Houthis present themselves is that they are part of the Iranian-backed axis of resistance, that they are helping to protect and defend their brothers in Palestine, as they put it, and they see Israel as the adversary. The shipping they are attacking, they say, has all got Israeli links. That isn't actually true. They've attacked a number of ships that have got no connection to Israel. But the point being that the global trade and shipping and container shipping community has been asking for the US-led coalition to do something about this, because it's forcing ships to go right round the other side of Africa, adding an extra 3,000 miles, 5,000 kilometres, 7 days of transit time for shipping that's going between Europe and the Far East, for example, Southeast Asia. So clearly something had to be done. But inevitably this will have raised tensions, and I think the way the Houthis will present this, and the way probably much of the Middle East will see this, is an extension of the Gaza war, which is very much not what the US and the UK want it to be seen as. They're saying, no, this is a separate issue, this is unprovoked attacks on shipping, which we have dealt with. But there's no indication that this is going to be the end of it. I think the Houthis are going to probably try and show that they are resilient in the face of these attacks.
Yeah, the Houthis say the US and Britain will pay a heavy price. How could they respond?
Well, the most obvious way is by doing a repeat of what they did on Tuesday, where they mounted a complex mass attack, which was repelled by US and Western warships. But they launched a combination of 21 drones, anti-ballistic missiles and cruise missiles at Western warships. Now, if they were to do that times three, there is a risk to Western warships that I think it could overwhelm their air defences. In the case of HMS Diamond, the Royal Navy destroyer, guided missile destroyer that is in the Red Sea, that had to deploy one of its close-in weapons, a 30mm Oerlikon machine gun, to destroy incoming ordnance. So that's really a kind of last-ditch weapon. When your missiles no longer are effective, you use a machine gun. And the Houthis, I think, would probably try to do something similar to score a hit on a Western warship.
Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Well, as we heard, many companies shipping goods between Europe and Asia are being forced to take the longer route around the southern tip of Africa. And the price of oil is also up 4% as a result of the attacks. The boss of the shipping giant Maersk, Vincent Clerc, warned that it could all affect consumers.
This is impacting all the goods, from medicine to food to anything that you would find in a supermarket shelf. Shipping prices have shot up as a result. So you see already that some of the costs is starting to percolate all the way down to the end consumer, which in these times of inflation is really something that we need to try to avoid.
Well, for more on what it means for firms and their customers, I spoke to our business correspondent, Will Bain.
You used this phrase, Ollie, and I think the right one, that this is a sort of choke point in global shipping. I mean, this is a choke point on a key artery. I mean, an artery that literally keeps the global economy going. And Vincent Clerc there talking about goods. Sure, lots of those come through this route, but everything else too, foodstuffs, energy. And already today on global markets, we're seeing, for example, the price of oil spiking up, the price of natural gas going up. So the longer that there is pressure on that choke point, then you are going to see it start dripping into everything we buy.
Yeah, I mean, we also saw Iran seize an oil tanker near Oman in the early hours of Thursday. Are shipping companies having to rethink their whole business models because of all this disruption?
Yeah, completely. The added costs are not just that longer route, if they choose to do it, as you were outlining, but it's also things like insurance, for example, or extra security. A lot of them are putting private security personnel on these ships now to try and protect their crews. And some have outright said that they're just not going to sail this route. One of the biggest, Hapag-Lloyd, have said in the last couple of days they just won't put their crews and ships at risk. But it does mean, of course, more fuel. You're paying more wages if it takes you twice as many days to get it there. And then it has an impact on your end consumer. You know, do they think you're breaching your contract and they want to charge you more or end the terms of that contract? And we're seeing it with the biggest companies on the planet, Olli, and the smallest. I was talking to a tiny furniture manufacturer in the UK. She's being affected. But also, we saw Tesla shutting down production in Germany overnight as well because of this. So having an impact on businesses big and small.
Our business correspondent, Will Bain. Other news now. And on the podcast this time yesterday, we reported on South Africa opening a case at the International Court of Justice accusing Israel of genocide in Gaza. Today, the Israelis are giving their response. Addressing the court, the legal adviser to Israel's justice ministry, Galit Raguan, acknowledged that there were civilian casualties in Gaza, but firmly rejected the accusation of genocide.
Urban warfare will always result in tragic deaths, harm, and damage. But in Gaza, these undesired outcomes are exacerbated because they are the desired outcomes of Hamas. In urban warfare, civilian casualties may be the unintended but lawful result of attacks on lawfully military objectives. International humanitarian law recognizes this reality and provides a framework for balancing military necessity with humanitarian considerations. These do not constitute genocidal acts.
I heard more from our correspondent at the court in The Hague, Anna Holligan.
Israeli lawyers accuse South Africa of trivialising and making light of the Genocide Convention, weaponising, they said, the term genocide. We've just come outside court. The hearings have ended. You might be able to hear some of the people supporting the Palestinians in the background. So Israel ran through a series of arguments, basically dismissing everything we heard from South Africa yesterday. They talked about statements that senior Israeli politicians had made, which they said did not constitute any form of genocidal intent. They also talked about efforts to move Palestinians out of harm's way, so dropping leaflets, asking people to travel to the south. And they said this wasn't about a forced displacement. It was about protecting civilian lives. The Israelis showed a number of images in court. They said they were responding to the 7th of October Hamas attacks, which they described as the biggest calculated mass murder of Jews since the Holocaust. And in these images, they showed alleged launch sites of Hamas militants, including in hospitals and children's bedrooms. So essentially, Israel has been arguing it's acting in self-defense in line with international humanitarian law, targeting Hamas rather than Palestinians themselves. So this, they say, cannot be understood to be any form of genocide.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. Turning to space now, and a British PhD student has discovered a ring-shaped structure more than a billion light-years across. Alexia Lopez, an observational cosmologist, presented her work at a conference in New Orleans. She's been speaking to the BBC's Michelle Hussain.
When I first started my master's by research, I was working on a new technique of mapping large-scale structures in the universe. So I was actually just testing the method first. And so I selected a few different test fields. There was this one particular test field that when I was looking with this new method, I saw this interesting dense arc of contours that were telling me there was this mass enhancement. And so this ultimately led to the giant arc discovery. Now, all of that work was done. The paper was published. That was all done a few years ago. And then I started using the newest data release. So the first thing I thought to do was, okay, I'm using this new data, so let me just have a look at the giant arc. What I wasn't expecting to see was that in the same field, there was this interesting ring structure slightly to the north of it. And that's when I slightly changed my field of view. I moved up to the big ring and thus started the analysis for this structure.
And it really is big, isn't it? Give us a sense of the scale of it and why that is so unprecedented.
This big ring is 1.3 billion light years across. So if we were to think of that as in looking at the night sky, that would mean it's about roughly 8 degrees across. So this is almost the equivalent of looking at 15 full moons lined up. So when you're looking at it in the sky, it is on the scale of the size of like these constellations. So it's actually huge in the sky. It would also have a diameter of 4.1 billion light years. And bearing in mind, from here to the edge of the observable universe is 45 billion light years. It's a fraction of this radius from us to the edge of our observable universe. So these structures are huge.
What is it like to discover something like this while you're still studying for your PhD?
It's both an amazing, thrilling experience, and it's also terribly daunting. Just being very, very aware of I am at the beginning of my academic career. So compared to the academic giants out there, I'm so aware of I don't have the expertise. And so when these academic people are saying to me, wow, this is great, this is a great discovery, I feel so out of place, but also it's an amazing, privileged feeling, but it's also very, very scary.
Alexia Lopez from the University of Central Lancashire. And still to come on the Global News podcast,
we are going to organise the best Nations Cup ever.
We'll be able to show off some of the country's assets. It won't just be Abidjan. They'll see all the beautiful things Ivory Coast has to offer.
Football fever in Ivory Coast as it prepares to host the Africa Cup of Nations.
A web of manipulation and terrifying abuse.
If he'd have said to do anything, I would have done it.
With a powerful religious figure at its centre.
There was no safe place.
You don't say no to him.
World of Secrets from the BBC World Service is back with a brand new season, investigating allegations surrounding the preacher TB Joshua.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at what the surprise and imminent abdication of Denmark's Queen Margrethe and the country's new king mean for all of Europe's royal families. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Since it seized power nearly 3 years ago, the military junta in Myanmar has been opposed by a range of forces, but it has always managed to maintain control. However, over the past 3 months, it's faced its biggest challenge yet, in the form of an offensive by an alliance of rebel groups known as the Three Brotherhood Alliance. They recently captured a town on the northern border with China, prompting Beijing to step in and broker a truce. So is this a win for the Brotherhood Alliance? I asked our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
I think the rebels are quite happy to hold on to what they've got. I mean, they've made these extraordinary sweeping gains over the last 2.5 months at the expense of Myanmar military positions, which have just crumbled. They now, in effect, control nearly all of the commercially viable parts of the Myanmar-Chinese border. So the ceasefire is something China wants because it wants trade to resume. It wants peace on its border. The province of Yunnan in southwestern China depends a lot on trade with Myanmar, so it's very important to them. And that's what they've got, a ceasefire. It appears as part of that, the Myanmar military junta has agreed to stop bombing positions that the rebels have taken. There's been very heavy bombardment from the air and a lot of damage to towns which are now in insurgent hands. We don't know when trade will resume. What has not been agreed is where the final territorial boundaries will be. The Myanmar military has been badly humiliated. The coup leader, General Min Aung Hlaing, has lost a huge amount of credibility, probably even among his own core supporters inside the junta, through the very poor performance of the military. And they, at these talks, the Myanmar military has been demanding a return of those territories that it's lost. These are really quite extensive. These rebel groups are absolutely not ready to do that. I mean, it strengthens their position. They're looking forward to a future where maybe there isn't a military government and where there will be a new federal settlement. And the stronger these groups are, the better deal they think they'll get under that. So it is only a ceasefire at this stage, and it's quite likely to be fairly tense with the possibility of conflict resuming.
Yeah, I was going to ask, will it hold, given the rebels will want to push on and the military junta will want to get its territory back?
I'm not sure what capacity the Myanmar military has for fighting to get that territory back. It's been very striking to see how many units have simply surrendered without fighting and how many of those units don't have frontline combat troops. I think the Myanmar military is badly overstretched, and I think these insurgent groups feel they've done very well. The real question is, will this encourage other groups opposing the military to fight much harder? They've been encouraged, but do they have the capacity? It might change the dynamics of this war.
Jonathan Head on events in Myanmar. Well, it was a shocking moment broadcast live on television. An armed gang taking over a TV studio in Ecuador, threatening staff and holding a presenter at gunpoint. The US State Department has now confirmed it's sending a top US military officer and several senior officials to the South American country to support President Daniel Noboa in his fight against the country's drugs gangs. Some of the worst violence in Ecuador has been taking place in the port city of Guayaquil, from where our correspondent Will Grant sent this report.
Diego Gallardo, known by his artistic name Aire del Golfo, was one of Guayaquil's best-loved musicians. Young, talented and proudly Ecuadorian, his music, called Tropi Pop, spoke of the melancholy and beauty of this complex Andean nation. The lyrics of this song are about staying on your feet no matter what's thrown at you, something which resonated with his fans across the country. Tragically, Aire del Golfo was a victim of the gang violence which gripped Guayaquil this week. He was caught in the crossfire as he went to pick up his son from school amid the chaos.
In fact, I was going to go to collect him, but as I was heading to the car, he said, "No, the children can live without me, but they can't live without their mum."
Diego Gallardo's widow, Camille Gamarra, is also an artist. She said her husband was a hero twice over for his actions to protect their child that day.
My eldest child isn't his biological son, and he displayed the depth of his love because he loved him with his whole heart, to the point that he's prepared to give up his life to protect him. For me, it's brave enough to bring up a child that isn't yours, and twice as brave to risk your life for someone. It says a lot about his character. He was always ready to give everything to everyone, not just family.
After the bloodshed, the city has been trying to return to something resembling normal.
I'm in La Bahia, a huge covered market in the centre of Guayaquil, made up of some 6,000 little stalls selling everything from counterfeit football jerseys and mobile phone covers to toys and street food. But I am also walking past dozens that continue to have their shutters down, their owners no doubt frightened that the wave of violence that's gripped this city isn't over yet.
For some families, though, the ordeal never let up. The power base of Ecuador's gangs is inside the prison system. Unverified video circulating online claims to show some of the around 180 prison officers being held hostage by the gangs inside the jails. Their relatives are growing desperate. Diego Ordóñez, head of Ecuador's Prison Workers Association, had some sharp criticism for the government's handling of the crisis.
As the prison security force, we've had to, and excuse my language, prostitute ourselves between institution and institution, between the ministries in search of funding and direction. Sadly, none of them have known how to run the prison service. We're without logistics, without kit, there's no uniforms, there's not protective gear, there's no strategy.
The government says the country is in a state of war. Hundreds have been arrested in raids or detained on the streets since the crisis began. Despite the plight of the kidnapped guards, this is not a time to cede to the gangs, the administration of President Noboa insists. As Diego Gallardo's family prepares for his funeral, his music will be his legacy to his conflicted city. He took his name, Aire del Golfo, from the air which blows through the Gulf of Guayaquil. It is an air which today hangs heavy with the threat of more violence and more bloodshed to come.
A report by Will Grant. Ivory Coast is preparing to host the Africa Cup of Nations for a second time. A country which suffered a civil war just over a decade ago has produced some of Africa's greatest players of recent times, including Didier Drogba and Yaya Toure. And these football fans in Abidjan can't wait for the tournament to kick off.
We are going to organise the best Nations Cup ever.
It will be important economically and it will help develop Ivory Coast.
I'm very excited. It can demonstrate to all that Ivory Coast is a very, very big nation. And organize this type of event, it's like powerful.
We'll be able to show off some of the country's assets. It won't just be Abidjan. They'll see all the beautiful things Ivory Coast has to offer.
Well, since the conflict ended, Ivory Coast has also become a growing financial power in West Africa. So could the Cup of Nations football further fuel its journey from political turmoil to economic triumph? BBC Sport Africa's Ian Williams reports from Abidjan.
Like many African countries, football is big business in Ivory Coast. The Ivorian government has spent at least $1 billion preparing for the 24-team competition, with the West Africans looking to boost the economy while serving up a feast of football. The lunchtime rush is on at one of Akuba Angola's restaurants in Abidjan. She founded a fast food chain in 2021.
The Cup of Nations coming in Ivory Coast is a very great opportunity for business because we have many people coming from over countries that discover what we are doing in Ivory Coast.
Civil wars brutalized Ivory Coast between 2002 and 2011. But today's stability means many people have returned in recent years. And now Ivorians are hoping to achieve both on and off the pitch at AFCON. The Nations Cup will be held in five cities. At the University Alassane Ouattara, Prow Yao Serafan, a professor of economics, told me why he believes the benefits will be spread around.
There will be an influx of supporters to Kohogo, San Pedro, Buwake and Yamoussoukro. So the hotels will be packed, traders will gain in terms of resources, and it will also create growth centers.
Since the civil war ended, and thanks to major investments and the strong showing of key commodities cocoa and coffee, the Ivorian economy looks set to become West Africa's second largest, overtaking Ghana, but still some way behind Nigeria. Professor Serafan still has some fears, though.
If we are not careful, and if we don't think about creating events that will be able to boost revenues from our stadiums, I fear that the country of elephants will produce white elephants.
So there are concerns, but also many opportunities, as Ivory Coast looks to make a noise during Africa's biggest sporting event.
Ian Williams in Ivory Coast ahead of the Africa Cup of Nations starting on Saturday. The days of having to remember hundreds of different passwords could soon be a thing of the past, as firms like Google introduce the use of passkeys as a default login. But with the rise of deepfake technology, is any method of verifying our identities completely secure? Our cyber correspondent Joe Tidy has been investigating with some surprising results.
How safe is your face?
Now we're inside the fraud lab.
At online identity experts on Fido, they ask this question every day. Surrounded by an impressive collection of different types of masks, Simon Horswell tries to think like a criminal and trick online facial ID systems used to verify customers on the apps of large companies, including banks.
These masks, as you can see, they vary in quality. And the trick there is some of them might look similar to the person that's on the document. But what we've found increasingly over the last few years, certainly, is that we've found more and more what I would call professional fraudsters. They've started using deep fakes in the biometric side of it.
Can I have a look at some of the technology that you're...
So it's At the moment, I think I've got it on my face, so if you just pop into the camera, you'll see that you actually...
So I could be you at the
right now, yeah.
Within a second, my face, as seen on the camera, switches to Simon's.
Yeah, that's my smart. Now, what I could do as well, because you sent us a single front-on shot, and again, this isn't from the video you sent.
This is from a still picture.
Yep, and I could have done this from an image on the internet, and now we're both you.
So weird.
At the moment, fraud experts like Simon are able to pick up on fakes, but things are about to get a whole lot busier for people like him as the world is moving rapidly towards a new technology that uses Face ID and other methods to protect our lives online. The new system is all the rage in tech keynote presentations.
Passkey.
So what are passkeys and why are they the future? If you think of an online login as a door, the current system of passwords is like a code. As long as someone has it, they can get in. A passkey is like a doorman, checking your code and your ID pass. Online services use your phone or computer to verify who you are with a thumbprint, facial ID, or the unlock code. It takes a bit longer to set up a passkey compared to the trusty old password method we've always done. So why the big shift? Well, it's because although convenient, passwords are not trusty at all. They're a terrible way to secure accounts. Corey Macy hacks into companies with permission for a living.
I would say that if a company is restricting things only by password, they're 100% vulnerable. We will always get in. People are really bad when they create passwords. 9 out of 10 times when I go into an environment and I try the password summer 2023 or winter 2023, you're going to get a few accounts.
Over the years, it has become possible to make passwords safer if you're willing to put in the work.
First of all, of course, you've got to have really complex passwords across every different online service. Impossible to remember, so then you need a password manager. Then you need to have multi-factor authentication as well. So if you try and log into a service that you don't normally have on, let's say this device, it's a hassle.
It's no surprise, really, that security experts have largely failed to persuade people to jump through all the hoops. It'll take years for passwords to be phased out.
Right, now I need to put that password into this account.
And no doubt criminals will come up with new ways to get around passkeys. But overall, the cybersecurity world is hoping that 2024 will be the year that the happy death of the password begins.
Joe Tidy reporting. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. Before we go, though, here's Jackie with news of this week's Happy Pod.
Yes, in the next edition, a very relieved rescuer in Slovenia after 5 people were brought out of a flooded cave. Extraordinary dedication in the Democratic Republic of Congo to save lowland gorillas by enabling ecotourism. Work in Barcelona to decode what a baby wants from its cry. Clans, culture and consensus among sperm whales, and the 93-year-old golfer proving that age is just a number if you've got the right swing. All in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, the 13th of January.
Thank you, Jackie. This edition of the Global News podcast was mixed by Pat Sissons and produced by Nikki Verrico. Our editors, Karen Martin, I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at what the surprise and imminent abdication of Denmark's Queen Margrethe and the country's new king mean for all of Europe's royal families. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.